Every year, thousands of Illinois high school graduates go to college, but nearly half of them leave the state to do so. It's a long-running problem that's only getting worse. Plus, massive flooding hit the Midwest this week, including Wisconsin and northern Illinois. We'll get the latest on how recovery efforts are going. And it's officially March Madness. Loyola Chicago is out this time, but Bradley and DePaul are representing Illinois in the men's and women's tournaments.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll get an update on how northern Illinois and Wisconsin are dealing with the heavy floods that have hit the Midwest this past week. And it's time for March Madness. One men's team from Illinois did manage to make it into the tournament. That's Bradley University. But first, speaking of universities, if you applied to college last winter, you're probably in the middle of the waiting game right now. It's a stressful time, and last week's news about dozens of people bribing college officials probably did not help. It's also a stressful time for Illinois' leaders, who are hoping that our high school graduates don't leave the state to attend a four-year college. But the latest numbers show that this problem is getting worse. In 2017, more than 48% of public high school graduates in Illinois who went to four-year colleges left the state to do so. Dawn Rhodes has been reporting on this. She's the higher ed reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I'm also joined by Eric Lichtenberger, Deputy Director of Information Management and Research with the Illinois Board of Higher Education. Eric, Dawn, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Brian.
Eric, let's start with you. I mentioned this number, 48.4%. For how long has this number been going up?
We have information dating back to 2002, and in 2002, 29% of the four-year college-going high school graduates enrolled outside the state. And we've actually seen a relatively large increase after the budget impasse. Prior to the budget impasse, we were experiencing increases of about 1% a year. And after the budget impasse, we've been experiencing an increase of about 3.5% per year.
Wow, so you're talking about a little more than or a little less than a third to a little less than half over the course of a couple decades.
Exactly, in a decade and a half, in 15 years.
Yeah.
So we found it kind of surprising. Fortunately, last year, the governor, in consultation with us and the legislature, created a new merit-based scholarship program called Aim High. And the freshman class of next year will start receiving that. And universities, public universities within the state of Illinois, have been using that in their recruitment and marketing materials.
Yeah.
So we're excited about that.
Sure, yeah. And I want to come back to what exactly we're doing policy-wise to try and fight this. But I wonder, does this set off red lights at the Board of Higher Ed? How does this feel to be watching this sort of slow-motion out-migration of, you know, the people you're supposed to be educating here?
Definitely. And I think that's why I'm on this radio program today, to sort of spread the word and try to figure out what we could do in terms of policy to at least bend the curve and, you know, maybe reduce that net number.
All right. So Dawn Rhodes is also with us from the Chicago Tribune. Dawn, you've been reporting on this. Where are these students going for college? And has that changed over the years, where they're going?
Sure. Yeah. So the data from the Board of Higher Education shows that the large majority of Illinoisans who leave the state for other four-year colleges are landing someplace else in the Midwest, so Iowa, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and so on. So we're talking about two-thirds of those numbers. But what I've seen and what the numbers that were released last week show is that states that are much farther afield are starting to be more successful in recruiting Illinoisans. So I did a story last year about the pretty sizable increase of Illinoisans going to University of Alabama, of all places. And And these are all, I mean, not all of them, but I mean, oh, these are majority very high achieving, you know, honor roll students. These are students that make the dean's list and the president's list at Alabama. Some of the data from the Board of Higher Education also showed that states further west, like Utah, Nebraska, certainly Texas, those are seeing some increases. Now, we're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of students, but these are states that in the past, Illinoisans maybe didn't consider all that much for school. And so you're starting to see states like that gain a little bit more of a foothold locally as well.
Yeah, and, you know, I can certainly understand the Midwest. I knew a lot of people who went, you know, my high school classmates, Indiana, Michigan, sure. Ohio, think places like that. But why Alabama?
Alabama is a really interesting story because, I mean, really, you know, Eric mentioned Aint High and the Merit Aid. That's really the big tool for Alabama. They've invested very, very heavily in merit financial aid, which for some of your listeners who maybe don't know what that means, that's financial aid that's not based on a family's financial need. So these are very, very generous scholarships. Sometimes these are full scholarships or close to full scholarships that are being awarded to out-of-state students that, like I said, are at the top of the class. These are valedictorians or, you know, these very, very high achieving students. And a lot of the families that I talked to said that was really the main attraction. They loved the campus. They loved the feeling, the environment there as well. But the price point was a really big selling point, and that these are all students who want to go to graduate school or medical school or something like that. So they were very intrigued and attracted by the prospect of being able to complete undergraduate school with very little, if no debt at all.
Yes. Okay. So that's the story of high achieving students who want to get academic aid or not need based aid. Is this in Alabama at least? Is this sort of a more general trend, Dawn, in the parents and students you've talked to about this? Is cost the factor that's pulling people away?
Absolutely. So anytime I write a story about this, I will hear from lots of parents who say more or less the same thing, that you know, they want their kids to go to Illinois schools, and a lot of them are Illinois graduates themselves and from U of I, Illinois State, and so on. And they just keep saying that it's just too expensive. My kid couldn't get enough financial aid here, so we had to look in Iowa. We looked in Alabama. We looked in South Carolina, just in any other top public institution around the country, and they were finding better offers. And yeah, so price is definitely a huge, huge consideration for most of the parents that I've talked to.
So Eric, do you have a sense, is that from your understanding of the data you look at it, I mean, do we know, is cost a factor? Do you hear that from people as well?
Not only is it cost, but a lot of times it's perceived cost as well. And,
sure.
And I think one thing we should bring up and mention is that within the state of Illinois, public universities are required to keep their tuition set for 4 years, sometimes five and 6 years. And I believe Western Illinois University also keeps their fees set, you know, throughout the course of an undergraduate student's academic career because of our truth in tuition policies. So a lot of times when a parent or a high school student is looking at net cost or cost of attendance or tuition and fees, it's not really an apples to apples comparison, in that if you attend school out of state, a lot of times there are going to be incremental adjustments based on inflationary factors. But in Illinois, the public universities are required to factor that in when they set that tuition rate that doesn't change. Throughout.
So, I mean, do the universities are setting maybe fees and costs that would be higher because they're looking, trying to look ahead 4, 5, 6 years to know what they're going to need? Is that
exactly? And if you attend college out of state in a state that doesn't have a truth in tuition policy, what you'll see is that over the course of a student's undergraduate academic career, the cost differential becomes smaller.
Okay. So Dawn, I also wanted to ask you, and you kind of touched on this in the story you did last week about this. The budget impasse, right? What this is obviously was one of the big stories of state government in the past 4 years. What happened to enrollment, you know, students leaving the state versus staying here after Illinois effectively zeroed out funding for higher ed starting in 2015 for a few years?
Yeah, so definitely the budget impasse is right around the time that I started covering higher ed, so I kind of almost don't even know anything else. But But yeah, definitely in 2016, 2017, you saw some pretty sizable percentage drops in enrollment, and particularly among first-time freshmen at many schools throughout the state. The notable exceptions are U of I in Urbana and UIC, which both of which saw some pretty sizable, especially UIC, saw some pretty sizable increases. But in some sense or another, a lot of those numbers went down for most of the public universities throughout the state. And definitely went down, at least from the data that I have on my computer, went down kind of, I think, as Eric was indicating, went down. Those decreases accelerated during the past years. Yeah.
And there was like a, I mean, I remember that time, there was a sort of a, the educational leaders were trying to fight this crisis mentality that's, or this crisis mm-hmm. narrative, I guess, that was out there, right? There were questions. Chicago State University was, you know, looking at sure. layoffs. And I mean, this was just in the air at the time.
Sure. And, you know, when I first started reporting on higher ed back in 2016, I mean, that when I talked to parents, that was the biggest thing that was on their mind, mm-hmm. that they were very concerned about the long-term stability of some of these institutions, certainly not of U of I or UIC. Those are, you know, much larger institutions, but like regional schools, you know, were definitely things that came up when I talked to parents, and they were just concerned about you know, layoffs, as you talked about, there were, you know, furloughs, and this was just in the news a lot. We reported a lot about this, not just the Tribune, but many other outlets. We reported a lot about just kind of how this was forcing schools to cut back on their budgets and spending. And it was very, very difficult time for almost all the schools in the state. And that was very, very distressing for a lot of parents, that they just didn't know that degree programs were going to survive, you know, that their, you know, if their kid wanted to pursue a particular degree, they weren't sure that that was going to be around in 4 years for them to be able to do that. That was definitely a comment I heard a lot.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So now we know that kids are leaving. We've often heard people say that when students do go out of state for college, they don't come back. And so Illinois, right. in a sense, you lose both students and skilled workers, potentially even jobs. Eric, do we know how true that is?
It's partially true. A student from Illinois who graduates from an Illinois high school, attends college in Illinois, is highly likely to become an Illinois taxpayer. About 95% of them end up in the Illinois workforce. If you're from Illinois, attend college outside the state, and complete your degree there, there's still a high likelihood that you'll come back. About two-thirds of the students from Illinois who graduate outside the state do return in some way, shape, or form. But relative to enrolling at Illinois, there's a huge difference. So, you know, if you look at the treatment effect of out-migration specific to the Illinois workforce, there is a deleterious effect of students enrolling outside the state. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're completing the degrees that we need to grow our workforce, degrees in STEM and degrees in the health and medical professions as well.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So Dawn, can you remind us what leaders in Illinois have been doing and have done over the years to try and reverse this trend? And let's start with just the universities themselves.
Sure. Well, the big thing I think Eric mentioned that at the when we started talking is aim high. That's definitely something that the entire state has really invested very, very carefully in. And those are that's a pool of state funding that the school that has been allocated to all the different schools that they can then award to incoming freshmen for fall 2019 for merit scholarships. And so, like I said, those are the same type of scholarships that other schools, especially Alabama and other out of state institutions, have used very effectively to attract Illinoisans and other out-of-state candidates. So that's something, and I believe, Eric, you might know this better than I do, but I believe Governor Pritzker indicated in his budget address that he wanted to increase the funding for that next year. So that's definitely something that it has been really important. And we won't really know how effective that is until the enrollment numbers come out for fall. But, you know, the schools are very excited about that. And individually, you know, University of Illinois has University of Illinois has unfolded a new program, Illinois Commitment, which is need-based financial aid for low to middle income families. And so that they've made a pretty big investment in that that they're going to do over the next 4 years. And more broadly, some of the regional schools like have partnered with U of I. So U of I has done like kind of joint recruiting events targeting certain parts of the state, Western Illinois, Northern Illinois, and Southern Illinois, to try to encourage local students just to get the word out a little bit more and try to encourage more local students just to apply to state schools, any state school. And so that's something that they have been doing for the last couple of years, actually.
Yeah. So, Eric, Dawn mentioned a moment ago about the governor, you know, and his budget address. And I know you work on the data side, not the numbers side necessarily, the budget side. But is it at least fair to say that the Board of Higher Ed is hoping for more state funding in order to, you know, stabilize the state universities?
That's what we were hoping for, and we were really excited with Governor Pritzker's budget proposal. I think it's moving us in the right direction, and specific to the AIM High program, his budget proposal calls for an additional $10 million on top of the $25 million that was allocated for this year. It'll start getting into the pockets of students next fall.
Yeah. So Dawn, did families tell you what it would take for them to consider staying in Illinois for college?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not just any one thing. So a lot of the things that we've been talking about, these are all varying, you know, a varying influence for families. For some of them, it really is a cost issue. And in order for that, this is very difficult, I understand, but a lot of parents say the tuition just needs to be lower. And that's much easier to say than do, obviously. Tuition has been going up for state schools for quite a while. And so it's not so easy just to, you know, reduce tuition by a half or, you know, whatever that magic number is for certain families. But you know, they've reacted pretty well to the idea of merit scholarships, and that's something that's very exciting for them. It probably won't affect, for the parents that I talked to, it probably won't affect their kids who are already kind of committed to going out of state. But unless the overall cost of college for a lot of these families comes down, it's very difficult to persuade them, and understandably so, because a lot of these families I talk to, they have more than one kid that they need to send to college. So it's not just one kid that they need to make sure that they invest in. They have to look, you know, further down the line for two or three other kids that need to go to college.
Mm-hmm. All right. Dawn Rhodes is a higher ed reporter with the Chicago Tribune. I want to thank her and Eric Lichtenberger, who's a deputy director at the Illinois Board of Higher Education. Eric, Dawn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dawn.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Farm income is down 50% since 2013, and at the same time, the number of farmers who have filed for Chapter 12 bankruptcy has been rising in Midwestern states like Nebraska and Kansas for three consecutive years. Those numbers don't sound good for the Midwest, so is it time to call this a farm crisis? Economists say probably not yet. Joining me on the line for more is Mike Dougherty. He's the senior economist for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mike, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And Esther Honig is also on the line. She's been reporting on this for Harvest Public Media. Esther, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Esther, as I just mentioned, farm income down 50% since hitting a high point in 2013. How did this happen? What are the factors behind this?
You know, farming is a volatile business. You're at the whim of weather. You know, we've just seen here in the Midwest, states like Nebraska, Iowa, Wisconsin, we have major flooding, and that has surely wiped out a lot of savings for a lot of farmers, you know, millions of dollars in damage. So that's one factor, is simply weather and these big catastrophes when they strike. But another big component of that is trade. So not only have the tariffs hurt dairies, but they've also slashed export markets for major crops like soybean. And as that grain piles up, it's pulling down the prices for commodities to a point where it's either at or below the break-even mark. So even if, you know, the tariffs are lifted and things are turned around, it's still going to take us a while to dig out of all that glut that we have in the commodity market.
You know, and it's interesting because you talked about dairy and soybeans and some of these individual industries within farming. So often those of us who are not steeped in this stuff just think of farming, right? So what can you expound on, like, sort of which particular aspects of farming are having maybe a more challenging time than others right now?
Dairies in particular are having a really tough time. You know, we're seeing Wisconsin, when it comes to farm bankruptcies, Wisconsin is really leading the state with 59 Chapter 12 filings last year. So those are farm bankruptcies. And that is likely mostly all dairies. We've seen those prices fall pretty steeply, again, because of trade disputes. But the trade disputes have also hurt soybean farmers and corn farmers, and that has rippled over into the effects, how it's affected cattle farmers. So it's really across a lot of sectors, but I would say those are the primary ones. Also pork. That's been a big one with exports to China.
Hmm. So, Esther, you and Grant Gerlach from Harvest Public Media have been reporting on this. I wanted to take a listen to a clip from your reporting. This is Nebraska farmer Ben Steffen, who raises beef and cattle along with corn, soybeans, and wheat. There's some background noise in this. It's Ben's trailer filling with corn.
We're in a situation where we're counting nickels and pennies on every transaction, and we're trying to capture every penny we can. When you've spent 5 years of your life pouring your energy into a business and you're worse off today than 5 years ago, it feels like a crisis.
Thanks to Harvest Public Media for that tape. Now, that's Nebraska farmer Ben Steffen. And Esther, I know he was talking to your colleague Grant Gerlach, but how have things been going for Ben and his operation? What led him to say that?
You know, I think that he's in a similar position to a lot of farmers when things get tight. You might take out more loans because you need to get by. You might be spending down your savings and hoping that things will turn around the next month or the next year. And it might, you know, look okay on paper. You might think, okay, we can make this work. But when you're in that position, as this farmer is, it's really scary to look at a herd of cattle and think, do I have enough to feed them? Or, you know, am I going to have to make a different decision tomorrow? I think there's a lot of folks out there losing a lot of sleep over some of those decisions.
All right. See, Illinois Farm Bureau senior economist Mike Doherty is also with us. Mike, you just heard from Ben Steffen, who's a Nebraska farmer who talked to Grant for his story. Does this sound familiar to you here in Illinois?
To some extent. It's a little tougher out there in the high plains states, Nebraska south to Kansas, especially 2 or 3 years ago. They had more loan delinquencies, farm loan delinquencies, and more stressed financially than we had here. However, we have a fair number of producers. We're hearing from our local bankers who do each year provide operating loans for farmers so they can put a crop into the ground and then they pay back those operating loans at the end of the year. And we're hearing that there's a fair number of the farmers here in Illinois that are in a stressful situation in terms of their income levels, and particularly their working capital levels are getting rather tight. That makes, of course, the banks nervous. You need that cushion if you're going to get loans to continue farming, and you need that working capital cushion.
Mm. And Mike, I also want to ask you about international trade, right? We've talked about the trade war here on the 21st a number of times, and I'm sure it's something listeners have been reading about. How do you think that has contributed to some of the financial challenges facing farmers?
Well, it clobbered the soybean market last year, which is why then the administration, USDA, ended up implementing a program to provide market facilitation program payments to help compensate for that decrease in the soybean market, which occurred because of the trade war with China. China was our number one customer in terms of the export market for soybeans, and Illinois is the number one soybean producing state in the country. So really hit us hard, and that's why they had the market facilitation program payments, was to compensate the farmers for that loss, because they had already planted their soybeans at the beginning of the year, last spring, a year ago, without knowing we were going to end up in a trade war with our number one soybean customer. So this year is a little different. Now we're going into 2019. our prices are lower than they would be if we had normal trade relationships with China. Those soybean prices would probably be, well, their projection for 2019 would be better. They might even be higher. They certainly, there's more risk right now, soybean prices going down because of the trade war with China. So to the extent that that trade war is still there, the Chinese have come back in and bought some United States soybeans, but it's a very small percentage compared to what they normally would have been buying. So we've lost sales there. We've also lost sales on pork exports as well. And pork exports, of course, represents, from a farmer's viewpoint, is corn on the hoof. And because that's what hogs eat, a lot of corn, and then you're exporting that pork. So we've lost some sales there. So it's affecting us pretty directly, this trade war, ongoing lack of resolving these differences between the United States and its major trading partners, particularly for agriculture.
Yeah. So an unresolved situation there. And Esther, when we think about these tough times for farmers, right? I've talked to young farmers. They say their parents have sat them down and told them the stories about the 1980s, right? And that's something that sort of looms large in the imagination as a tough time for agriculture. Esther, are you hearing farmers drawing comparisons between then and now?
I am not hearing that straight from farmers, no. I would just say it's mostly economists, folks that are out there trying to assess what the current industry looks like. And there are some of those sort of, red flags popping up that have people concerned that we're going in that direction. I think that's why you've seen a lot of reporting lately that looks at the number of farm bankruptcies, the delinquency rate on loans to farmers. These are the sorts of indicators that experts look to see, are we going down that path again? I think so far, I don't know what Mike has to say, but so far I've heard that the conclusion is no, not yet. Things aren't great, but we're not, historically speaking, we're not in a crisis or on the brink of one just yet.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Mike.
Well, that's exactly right. I would agree. We are not in the equivalent of an early 1980s farm crisis by any means. We are not in that kind of a crisis. That back then you had falling asset values for the level of debt the farmers had, so they were insolvent, and the banks would look at them and say, wow, you have negative net worth, I can't keep you as a customer. Now our debt to asset ratios in agriculture and through the Corn Belt here are actually pretty good. They're higher than they've been in many previous years, so we're not over indebted. What we have are problems with cash flow, working capital, stress in terms of delaying repayment on loans. So it's not all the farmers. We probably, it could be a third of them, and there's also a third that are actually have managed to reduce their costs, restructure their loans, and have gotten some better yields. Last year we had the best soybean yields we ever had, and so that has, for a lot of the farmers, that actually 2018 turned out to be a pretty good year. But looking forward, 2019, I think saying we're going down a road here of continuing or an increasing financial stress amongst grain farmers and livestock farmers, I would say that's true. We are on a pathway to increasing financial stress.
Well, Esther, I want to drill down then a little bit. You talked about those red flags. We just heard Mike talking about financial stress. And one of those things that you and your colleagues have been looking at is this idea of bankruptcy, right? Last year, nearly 500 farms filed for Chapter 12 bankruptcy. Can you just sort of help us understand how Chapter 12 came about, how it works?
So it was developed during the 1980s farming crisis, and that's when you just saw scores of farms going under, and it was written as a way to help support the American farmer. It's a lot friendlier than your typical bankruptcy. The idea is to help the farmer restructure their debt. That gives them about, I think, 3 to 5 years to restructure that debt so that they can stay in operation. The goal here isn't to, make them liquidate their assets or things that maybe a typical business would be put through, because the idea is that these are the folks who are producing the food for Americans, so they need to have a special safety net, especially because their industry is so volatile. So the Chapter 12 was created in the 1980s and became a permanent part of the U.S. bankruptcy code in, I believe, around 2005. And it is a tool that a lot of farmers use, that they rely on. It doesn't. What is really exceptional about Chapter 12 is that it doesn't mean the barn doors are shut. It is often, most of the time, an opportunity for them to continue farming, to hold on to the land that they've had in their family for generations. And it's one of the key indicators that economists look to gauge the ag industry, because it is only available to family farmers and family fisheries. So it's a very it's an easy way to look at and see, okay, how's the farm sector doing in each state and across the country.
Yeah, and there's some limits on it, right? So it's, you said it's targeted for family farmers. You have to have, what, 50% of your annual income has to come from farming, and there's a debt limit as well?
Yes, it's about $4 million. So you can't have, it's a little bit over $4 million in debt in order to qualify. And it's important to note that there are farms out there that are too big to qualify. They have too much debt. You know, 98% of farms in America are still run by families, but the size of the American farm has gotten bigger. The USDA did tell me that they've seen, most family farms still qualify for Chapter 12. They have seen an increasing number of farms that do not. And I spoke with several farm bankruptcy lawyers in Colorado who told me they had seen more and more customers who were not able to qualify for Chapter 12 because of that debt limit. You look at just commodity prices, for example, and in order to make a profit, you're going to have to scale up your operation. The cost of a new combine can run you nearly $500,000. I mean, it's a costly business, and that can mean higher debt. That can mean needing to increase that debt limit if you want to be able to make that safety net available to all farmers.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, as Esther explained, farmers have this limit of $4 million in debt, which a lot of farms are perhaps exceeding for Chapter 12. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa has introduced legislation last year, apparently plans to reintroduce it this year. It would raise that debt limit from $4 million to $10 million. Do you think this would be a good thing?
Yeah. We have some issues with it is a limitation on the usefulness of that option of a Chapter 12 family farm bankruptcy because of the debt limit. However, I want to kind of emphasize that we've had very low rates of the bankruptcy here in the Corn Belt, that most of the bankruptcies, as others have been talking and reporting on, has been up in the Dairy Belt, up in Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota. So, we haven't had as much of an issue with it here as other parts of the country have had.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, Mike, I want to ask, what do you think in a more sort of big picture way? There was something about one of the stories that Harvest did with that farmer we heard from earlier, Ben Steffen, said, farming can be a fun enterprise if you don't mind losing sleep and borrowing a lot of money, which pithy comment. But I wonder what in a big picture sense can be done to ease the financial burden on farmers.
Right now it would be consistency and resolution on the trade treaties, without a doubt. I mean, that's where the anxiety is coming from, is Illinois in particular, but even just the whole corn soybean belt, were built on exporting. The United States only has 300 million people in it. We can't eat all the corn and soybeans that we grow that feed the livestock, and we have to export it to have a market. And our production, we're very good at growing corn and soybeans, and production has outstripped the demand domestically, so that we export. And yet we have issues. We're ongoing, lack of resolution in trade with China, which is the biggest one of all. And then also, wanting to get this USMCA Act, some people are calling it NAFTA 2.0 or whatever, resolved and signed and ratified by U.S. Congress, Canada, and Mexico, so that we, Mexico is our number one market for both corn and pork coming out of Illinois. So we really want to make sure we take care of Mexico.
Okay. That's Mike Dougherty, senior economist for the Illinois Farm Bureau. We also spoke with Esther Honig, who's been reporting on this for Harvest Public Media. Mike, Esther, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll tweet out a link to Esther's reporting. You can find that on our Twitter page. We are at 21st Show. Coming up after the break, people throughout the Midwest are continuing recovery efforts after devastating flooding displaced thousands. We'll get an update on how the recovery is going in northern Illinois and Wisconsin. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. Massive flooding in the Midwest over the past week has forced thousands of people from their homes. At least three deaths have been associated with the flooding so far, and Nebraska, Iowa, South Dakota, and Wisconsin have all declared emergencies. Recovery efforts are continuing today. Towns in Illinois have been hit as well, especially in the Rockford area and along our western border with Iowa. Sarah Jesmer has been reporting on the flooding in Winnebago County in northern Illinois. She's with WNIJ, and she's on the line with us now. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Our neighbors to the north in Wisconsin have also seen heavy damage. For an update on the situation there, Meg Jones is also with us. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meg, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Meg, what is the situation now where you are in southern Wisconsin?
Well, we've still got areas of moderate flooding. We've got just some localized major flooding. Like most, what people are seeing now is that the water, that the flooding that we had last week up in Wisconsin is now slowly making its way southward. So while central Wisconsin and some parts of southern Wisconsin are starting to, dig out and roads are slowly starting to reopen, the headache is now moving southward into Illinois and other places.
Yes, so I was going to ask when the worst of this was. This is it's peaked last week, and but we're feeling the downstream effects, literally, I guess.
Yes, well, because we got so much rain last week and the temperatures warmed up, so we had just mountains and mountains of snow. Literally mountains of snow, and the ground was frozen. So as it melted, as it rapidly melted, the ground couldn't absorb it, and so that's why we had the flooding going across roads. I was out driving around the central south central area, and on some roads where you think, oh God, I'm passing through today, like this morning, but when I come back this afternoon, I'm probably not going to be able to get through because the water was just literally right up against the side of the road.
Wow. Wow. All right, Sarah, so when we think about flooding here in Illinois, we're often talking about the Mississippi and western Illinois, but we're also seeing flooding in areas in northern Illinois. What is the situation in Winnebago County, Sarah?
Yeah, so I've done some reporting in Stevenson County and Winnebago County. Those are two counties just below the state border. The Rock and the Pecatonica Rivers in these two counties are flooding their banks. Flooding isn't new for these two counties, but the levels are unprecedented in some areas. A lot of the damage in the Rock River is those on the riverbank. There's lots of streets that are blocked by law enforcement or actually water on the streets. I saw garages covered by water in some places, but in others, no water at all. Freeport is in Stevenson County. It's had some of the worst damage that I've seen. Citizen footage on social media show inches of water covering street corners and gas stations. More than 170 people have been evacuated in the Freeport area. There's been some water rescues that had to be done. The governor is visiting today to look at some of the damage. I talked to Lowell Crow. He's the city manager in Freeport. He said he can't even estimate the cost of the damage yet.
The residents are not allowed back in the area right now. We did offer sand. We put out sand on last Thursday. It allowed them to bag. But you got to understand that we have seen water in buildings that have never had water. There's a St. Paul's Missionary Baptist Church, which has never gotten water in the last 60 years, that has 4 inches of water throughout, 3 to 4 inches of water throughout to the sanctuary. We only have one area that's even dry, and that's the parking lot for the school.
So, Sarah, what about Freeport makes it especially vulnerable to flooding?
Floods aren't new to these communities. They're flood-prone areas. They're designated. Even last spring, residents saw water damage that required Red Cross intervention as well. Factors to flood-prone areas have to do with infrastructure or topography. I can't speak to the specifics about why this continues to happen in these communities, but Freeport is in a rural wetland. There's creeks and ponds that are sprinkled around the area that all flow into or out of the Pecatonico River. Water levels did rise to levels that they haven't seen since 1933, says the city manager. This is because of rain and that melting snow that we mentioned up in the Wisconsin. In McChesney Park, that's a town in Winnebago County, I spoke to a resident on the riverbank whose sprawling backyard and his parts of his street disappeared underwater. That's Dave Brown. He lives in Latham Park. He says those on the Rock River want to see some answers about the way that dams on the river are utilized to prevent flooding.
Get Rockford to Rockford or ComEd open the dam down there. That's the sore spot with me. I don't know who makes the decision when to open the dam, but they can see by the graph that we see that's available to everybody that, hey, next week it's going to start going like this. Boom, they should open the dam. But they seem to be worried about fishermen down there and boats in the winter for some reason. There shouldn't be any boats on the water to begin with. I'm really upset about that.
So, Meg, is there any sign that we'll get some time to recover? Is there more rain in the forecast?
Yep, I think so. And I should probably mention to Sarah, sorry, all this water that's on the Pecatonica on the Rock, that started up here.
Means a lot.
And we're sending all of our water down that way. There is good news on the – oddly enough, though, you know this is Flood Safety Awareness Week this week, which I guess is kind of interesting enough. There is good news on the front. We've had a couple of days of dry weather. We're supposed to get some scattered showers in southern Wisconsin tonight, but nothing of much that will add up to much, which is good news because there's even though the water is going down, we still have lots of rivers with ice jams. I mean, it's warmed up, but there was just so much ice, and the ice was so thick on some of the rivers and lakes that we've got ice jams that are pushing up. And in fact, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District had to send out 281 million gallons in sewer overflows during last week's flooding. And that's the first time that happens with some regularity, but that's a huge amount. But the good news is that this water should be going down fairly soon. It is already here in Wisconsin. I guess what's happening here in Wisconsin will be happening fairly soon in northern Illinois, where you'll be seeing the rivers cresting and then going down.
Well, Sarah, we just heard Meg mention it's Flood Awareness Week or Flood Preparedness Week, I guess. What advice is being given to residents? I guess this question is for both of you, but let's start with Sarah. What advice is being given here?
Yeah, so officials are urging people to evacuate risky areas if they haven't already. There are shelters that are set up in Freeport and Rockford that can help people with food or sleeping either in the daytime or nighttime. So people are encouraged to go there. Tonight in McChesney Park, there is a meeting for those who are affected by the Rock River flooding. The county sheriff, the National Weather Service, ComEd, and some government officials are going to be there to talk about flooding response. And McChesney Park is encouraging people to attend that informational meeting.
And Meg, any different advice in Wisconsin?
Yep. Up here in Wisconsin, many of our shelters have started to close and as the roads are starting to reopening, but the Red Cross is handing out cleaning kits, bleach and buckets and that kind of stuff to kind of help, you know, with the aftermath. I know for more localized flooding, we had to put out Wisconsin Emergency Management had to put out the word if you're not underwater, but you should look to your the drains and your streets, because a lot of times they get clogged with leaves and debris, and then all of a sudden things back up very, very quickly. So they had to put out the word to please, you know, look at the drains and the you know, next to your streets, because otherwise then that's going to back up the water, and then people are driving through that. And if we get another cold snap, then that freezes up as well, too.
Sure. All right. Well, we know Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois will be in Freeport this afternoon surveying flood damage. We'll continue to follow this story and monitor recovery efforts in Winnebago County and throughout the Midwest. Sarah Jesmer is a reporter for WNIJ, and Meg Jones is with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thank you both for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's officially the time of year when 64 college basketball teams vie for the national title in what's known as March Madness. Last year, we put our hopes in Sister Jean and the Ramblers of Loyola University Chicago. They had a great run and made it to the Final Four. This year, there are plenty of Big Ten teams to keep an eye on, and thanks to a first-place finish at the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament, Bradley University will be the only Illinois team in the men's tournament this year. They'll play their first game tomorrow afternoon against Michigan State. DePaul is the only Illinois team in the women's tournament. Chicago Tribune sports writer Teddy Greenstein is on the line with us now to give us his picks. Teddy, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
You got it.
So let's start with the only Illinois men's team to watch this year, Bradley University. Before we get into your expectations for them, I also wanted to talk about something off the court that made headlines last week. What happened that got them into hot water?
Well, so Bradley's had a long time beat writer, Dave Reynolds. He's been covering them on and off for like 29 years. And the school, in its infinite wisdom, decided it was going to limit his access because they haven't liked some of what Dave Reynolds has been writing. So totally mishandled it and tweeted out about it. And I think the school anticipated people were going to be on their side. But instead, pretty much everybody came down on the side of journalism and on the side of Dave Reynolds because Bradley came off as very, very thin-skinned and telling a reporter that you're here to promote our brand. So Bradley backed off, and now the focus can be back on their players.
Yeah, well, right. And so, okay, let's talk about their players then. Although it is, I guess, a positive story to hear some people siding with journalists in 2019. But anyway, this is Bradley's first tournament appearance in 13 years. And as the 15 seed, they've got a pretty tough first game against Michigan State. Are you optimistic about their chances?
Definitely not. Michigan State, I cover a lot of Big Ten basketball. I really don't cover the Valley very much. But Michigan State is a wonderful team coming off a Big Ten tournament crown at the United Center. They were down to Michigan in the final game, scored the final 10 points despite a bunch of injuries and one of their players having to be carted off basically with what looked like a serious ankle injury. And of course, Tom Izzo's program has been the class of the Big Ten for the last really almost 20 years, seven Final Fours. Michigan State is really, really good. So unless Bradley catches the Spartans on an extreme off game, it's going to be a short stay for him.
Yeah, and so what about the rest of – I mean, I know you're a Northwestern fan. Illinois is not in the tournament, but there are Big Ten teams to watch. Who are you most excited about following this year?
Well, I think Michigan is going to should have a really good run. This is a team that's been, you know, terrific under John Beilein. Made it to the championship game last year against Villanova. Looked great at the United Center until really the last just couple minutes against Michigan State. But it's a really well-balanced team, good mix of young guys, got some vets, got scoring, got some inside play with John Teske, and a wonderful coach in John Beilein, who really gets the most out of his guys, and especially late in the season. They really pick up their system as the season goes on. So Michigan is exciting. You know, Purdue did not win a game in Chicago at the United Center. So, you know, those players are looking at it like, okay, we're fresh. You know, we didn't have to exert ourselves very much. So Purdue is certainly will be looking to make a run. But there are a bunch of teams that certainly have a chance to make some noise. I mean, Minnesota has a tough draw, and that even if it gets the round of 32, it would have to play Michigan State. Ohio State's in there. Maryland is a talented team, but very young. I think there are actually a lot of tough matchups for the Big Ten. So Michigan and Michigan State are certainly the two best chances to reach the Final Four.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time, but you know, this is obviously the time of year when people are filling out brackets. You mind telling us who do you have to win it all this year?
Yeah, I picked Duke. You know, Duke would potentially face Michigan State in the Elite Eight. The committee did Michigan State no favors by setting them up for that potential matchup. Duke with a healthy Zion Williamson is absolutely the most dominant team in America. But, hey, there are actually two other ACC teams that on a given day can beat them. One is Virginia, one is North Carolina. So hard to pick against Duke this year, but we'll see what happens.
Okay. That's Teddy Greenstein. He's a sports writer for the Chicago Tribune. Teddy, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
That's all we have time for today. Tomorrow we'll be speaking with Chicago author Alex Kotlowitz about his book, An American Summer. We'll also be talking about the last surviving video stores in this new millennium. Do you still rent videos at a store? We want to hear from you. Leave us a voicemail. Our number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Our website is 21stshow.org. You can find past shows there. Or if you want to leave us a voicemail or send us an email. We're on Twitter at 21stshow. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.